This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly, a prime cut of Premier League fixtures to chew through. The Villa is now officially a fortress, 14 home wins on the spin, and Manchester City tempting us into saying there is a title race. Elsewhere, the voice note machine is being cranked up after Fulham cause a forest fire at the Cottage. Even the best guy on the planet can't help Sheffield United to a win. We'll rehash some of the age-old favourites. Is Scott McTominay good? What's going on with Arsenal's goalkeepers? And do Chelsea need to sign some more players? Meanwhile, in the Nations League, there's no iron team and no Team GB at the Olympic Games, despite England hammering Scotland at Hampden Park. All of that, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Our panel today, Will Unwin. Good morning.
Good morning, Robin.
And good morning to Nooruddin Chowdhury.
Hello.
And Johnny Liu in a hotel room with no chair.
Yeah, I'm up in Manchester, and as much as I would love to have a chair, I don't.
That seems like quite a big omission from a hotel room, but...
That's not the only thing that's missing. Also, the shower dripped all night and kept me up.
That sounds like a classic My Cousin Vinny sort of situation.
Yeah, well, Joel's just said this is the most northern pod football weekly ever, and that's kind of, we're really starting well, aren't we? Before we begin, a huge thank you to all of our listeners who voted for the pod at the Football Supporters Association Awards. Won Best Podcast once again, and I can only assume that Max and Barry are still on the open bus tour. That's why they're unavailable for this pod. So lots to get through. Let's start at Old Trafford. So-called crisis club, Manchester United 2, Chelsea 1. And Johnny, you're up north, you're at Old Trafford. How was it?
Very good game. I mean, I think United were superb. They obviously missed a penalty early on. And then, you know, they just started with this kind of in this relentless attacking mode. The crowd got into it and they didn't really kind of let up. And the only times when, when they did let up was when Chelsea just kind of inexplicably just managed to run through them and have a 4-on-2 counter-attack, which they would then inevitably mess up. And I think that's the kind of the bargain, the Faustian deal that you're getting with Manchester United, and especially with Scott McTominay, who's proving so effective as that sort of extra man in the box and popped up with a goal in each half, could even have had a hat-trick, actually. He was joking afterwards about how he kind of blew his hat-trick. And he's playing so well in that role because Ten Hag is basically... got him to be that agent of chaos in the final third, you know, be the extra man, be the overload, make those runs. And, you know, the upshot is that it's kind of leaving them short in midfield. And that's why Chelsea kept countering them. And Nicholas Jackson had a bit of a mare. I thought Cole Palmer was actually very poor until his very good goal, his equaliser. So it was one of those games where I thought 4-1 wouldn't have been a weird result, and also 1-1. That's just kind of where these two teams are at the moment. Just two very weird teams. But United, I think as, like, they're quietly building something. I don't know what it is, but I feel like there's something coming together.
With extra dripping shower, perhaps. But yes, Shane says, at what point is Scott McTominay genuinely in the Ballon d'Or conversation? Noz, this was actually a good Manchester United performance, which must be very disconcerting for you.
It is, yeah. I mean, we're not used to... I mean, I think this might be the first game of the season where it's been like a complete performance finish to end, which was half decent. It was a really good game, but part of that is obviously because both teams are sort of, to a certain extent, inept. So it's kind of like you don't know if it's a good game because teams are playing well or both teams are equally sort of frail. But yeah, it was end-to-end. And United played well in general. McTominay is on fire. He's actually always been like a good finisher. I don't think that's the issue with him. It's more a case of whether he can do a job in midfield. But maybe Ten Hag has found a solution to how to use him in the current problems in terms of, like, he seems to be the only player who, when the ball comes to him, you kind of have a half... United have half a chance of scoring. So He did well in that respect. I thought it was Amrabat's best game for United. He's had a few good games at fullback, but when United signed him, the hope was that he'd be a bit of a bully in the middle, which he was, and he did that really well in this game. But yeah, there was still the amount of times United were wide open, and it was just Chelsea being poor. That they didn't take advantage of that, but no, really enjoyed it. Like may it continue. Like if the Faustian pact is that there's this sort of game where at least it's not turgid and either team could win, like bring it on.
And Will, they are United now 3 points off the top four, 3 points off Manchester City. How has this happened? Where's the narrative?
Just willing to pass on the crisis baton over Manchester United for For so long in the Premier League, when they'd won 5 out of 6, they were grinding out results. I was at Luton at home and they were poor, they were slow, but they got a result. And getting results is all that matters in football, and getting results builds confidence. And at some point, I felt it was going to click, and maybe last night was it. I was at Galatasaray away, and going forward, they were really good, but the midfield was mildly farcical, which didn't help, and obviously the goalkeeper. But they've got those elements, and I think Rashford being out of the team has helped. I think he's lacked energy and efficiency and overall competence on the left. And Garnacho brought all of that yesterday. And they do have a decent squad. And if they get together and work how they're supposed to and have the natural X factor that is Scott McTominay, you're always in with a chance of beating teams, because he is the agent of chaos, as Johnny says, bringing in that extra element in the box, running from deep, being a surprise. And so they do have all the tools that they need. They probably just needed that extra bit of confidence and I think a bit of faith in their own ability, because they've really struggled with that, especially in Europe when you've seen them. And defensively, they're looking a little bit more competent. There was, say, Amrabat played well. It was his best game, because his other games are pretty terrible, to be fair. But having a midfield would be a useful skill for United from, the start of the season when Wolves just walks through them. It's not really being addressed too well. But it's getting there with Amrabat, Mainoo looking decent when he's played. But obviously you can't rely on an 18-year-old defensive midfielder to solve all your problems. And the problem with United now is that they've had a few false starts that they need to kick on and, carry on this form from Wednesday night.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because I think perhaps the results and the sort of chaotic performances in the Champions League have sort of clouded where they are in the Premier League, because they're a lot better off there. You alluded to it, Johnny. I mean, Chelsea, what on earth do you make of them as a team? They've now lost 17 of 38 league fixtures in 2023. Do they need to keep trusting the process with Pochettino now?
I think so. I mean, Pochettino said after the Newcastle game, where they lost 4-1, that it was the only game he thought they deserved to lose. And I think this was another one. I mean, they look like a team that are just, they're two or three steps away from clicking, and when it all makes sense, and at times this season it has made sense. The City game, which the 4-all, which certainly in an attacking sense, they managed to get those, they managed to play through the press and coordinate their counter attacks in a way that actually they really didn't here. They would often, they would break 3 or 4 on 2, and you'd have Jackson and Mudrick and Sterling all running around, and they weren't kind of coordinating with each other. You didn't get the sense that they were anticipating each other's movements. You got the sense that they were kind of reacting to each other, which is still the hallmark of a team, I think, that is getting to know each other's movement. And at the back, I think they're all off, they're all working at slightly different paces. Cucurella started at right back, which I thought was a strange one. He came off Reece James, who I didn't think was much better. I thought Enzo and Caicedo had a really poor game in midfield. And this has been Chelsea. They haven't managed to put all the constituent parts together. I really like them. I think they're a lot of fun, and I think a lot of neutrals enjoy watching Chelsea. But I think Chelsea fans are getting quite frustrated with how they are, they're being so open, and they're going into games, they're going at teams with abandon, but not getting the rewards at the attacking end of the pitch, and not being able to keep them out at the defensive end of the pitch either.
That old proverb comes to mind: if Manchester United win, but there's no one there to report it, did it actually happen? Yes, in a very Definitely not a club in crisis move. Manchester United banned journalists from four media outlets from Tuesday's news conference pre-match with Erik ten Hag. Before we go any further, have any of you thinking, Will, or I'd be very disappointed, Johnny, if you'd never been banned from a press conference, surely, in your time?
I got banned by Leicester a few years ago for calling Jamie Vardy a racist.
Really?
It was never formally lifted, but I am kind of welcome back now. It's a badge of honour, right? I think if you're one of the outlets that got banned, you know, you feel like you've taken one for journalism while in fact just getting a morning off work.
But no, it's not a great look, is it, when clubs start doing that?
No, it's not. But then you kind of, with the United, it's always a case, you wonder, is it slightly a case of Fergie cosplay? Where it's like, we all know how what Fergie was like when he came up against journalists he didn't like. So yeah, maybe there's a bit of that. But yeah, like who do you blame? Do you blame the journalist who's just reporting what the source said? Or do you look at who the source might be and what the problems are in the dressing room? But yeah. It's all fun and games, and yeah, as Johnny said, it's nice for journalists to feel as if they're sort of fighting the good fight and almost too dangerous to sort of be there.
They said it wasn't for publishing stories we didn't like, but for doing so without contacting us first to give us the opportunity to comment, challenge, or contextualise. I'm not sure you can give some insight into this, Will. Obviously, I mean, that seems like a kind of fairly reasonable thing to ask. How do these things work generally?
Yeah, if you have a story, the general rule is that you go to the club and you explain what it is and that you're going to publish it and you give them a reasonable amount of time to come back at you. There's no need for an official statement with a story like this, so I can see why it wasn't done. Generally, banning journalists is just a dreadful idea. It just highlights the story even more. It's a massive overreaction. And you have to accept what is a free and fair press. You know the journalists that are involved are very good at their jobs, so it's likely to be a very good story. And United flying off the handle, I don't think helps them at all. And obviously, historically, they've been very good at it. Even if it, in the good old days, it wasn't the director of communications that did it. But yeah, so hopefully the journalists will take their one match ban and no more will happen. You know, the best way to silence journalists that are critical of your club is to win football matches. So I'd advise Manchester United to do more of that.
Robin, have you ever been banned? Has a club ever kind of taken issue at your commentary or you know, how you've presented them?
Oh, I'm absolutely certain of that, but news hasn't reached me. Absolutely certain. No, I know past experience that they do sometimes bring it up. Oh, I didn't like the way you said that. I think, yeah, a certain current Palace manager in particular seems to watch Match of the Day quite diligently. But more on that later. To Villa Park, Aston Villa 1, Manchester City 0. We will, of course, talk about the new crisis club in Manchester, but let's start with Aston Villa. Stuart says, are Villa in the title picture? Exceptional performance from them. They're now just 4 points off Arsenal, who are top. Noz, is it time that we took them seriously as not just Champions League contenders, title contenders, Aston Villa?
I mean, why not? I remember when I first got into football, like Villa were right up there when teams were allowed back into Europe. Villa with the team in the European Cup, so yeah, bring it all back, bring Mitre copiers back and all that business. So I'm right up for it. I mean, to be fair, like, even top four would be amazing. I think Villa have kind of replaced Brighton in that. Do you know, you've always got that club in the Premier League that are like the barometer of, like, if you do things well and if you organise as a club and if you do everything the right way, it's almost you almost compare bigger clubs with more money to them and kind of say, well, why can't Manchester United do it, or why can't whoever, Newcastle or Liverpool do it if Villa are doing it? I think Villa have actually replaced Brighton as a club who are doing everything right, or they seem to be at the moment. And quite apart from the results and the amazing home form, like, they're just fun to watch. They're at risk of becoming that dreaded everyone's second favourite team. But yeah, it was really good. And by all accounts, they were the result flattered City.
Yeah, well, perhaps the biggest thing they've done well is dispensing of Steven Gerrard and getting Unai Emery. This is his first win over Pep Guardiola in quite a few attempts. Aston Villa had 22 shots to Manchester City's 2. 2 attempts, Will, the whole game. I think we've attempted more during the first half of this pod.
Yeah, and you know, we've had more on target in terms of our views in City. Mm. Yeah, and those two shots came in the matter of about 10 seconds as well in the one good attack that City produced. I mean, it was mildly laughable, the difference in quality between the two teams. And I don't watch Aston Villa every week, but you listen to, you know, what Andy Townsend, who I'm sure does watch far more than I do. Leon Bailey was incredible, but that was his best game. So if you can get him to do that every week, then yeah, you've got to say they've got the level of players that can reach top four. They've got Ollie Watkins, who's a striker that scores goals, which is a very sensible policy to have as a football club. Across the back four, didn't really give Erling Haaland a sniff. I know he didn't get much service, but you know, incredible performance there. Lucas Digne getting down the left was very good. John McGinn in midfield, Douglas Luiz, they're all really, you know, having a really good season. The age-old question will be for Villa is whether they can maintain it with Thursday nights and weekend football. And so you might have to, you know, review the matter in March to see where they all are. But you know, it's a sensible club that have created a diligent recruitment plan, brought in players for the right roles, done their research to make sure they fit in. And, you know, they all knit into a system that Unai Emery wants to play. You know, maybe if Steven Gerrard was there, they'd be top of the league by now. But who knows? Who knows? But yeah, it's an incredible job that he's done. And if you know, if you watched that game last night, we're told that team won the treble. One team won the treble last season, and one team, you know, was looking at relegation in about October. You'd be surprised to find out the answer of which was which. But yeah, it's incredible from Villa and City. Really struggling at the moment, as Guardiola said. I think, you know, that's his exact words, they're struggling. And it's, you know, it's a few chickens coming home to roost that Guardiola likes to have a small squad. So when you have a few injuries and a couple of suspensions, it really does, you know, show up, especially when one of those suspended is Rodri. Last season, he got 5 bookings. His 5th booking came in late April. He's already got 5 this season and a sending off. And, you know, what are the reasons behind that? I think he's played a lot of games, so he's a lot more tired. So that's an issue for him, and might explain why he's getting bookings. But also, the loss of Ilkay Gundogan in that midfield, I think, is very, very stark. And not finding it's obviously impossible to find an exact replacement, but, you know, Kovacic isn't that guy. Nunes has struggled with a step up from Wolves to City. And it'll take time. Like, you know, most Guardiola signings, it does quite often take a season for players to really settle. And, you know, Nunes is probably suffering from the fact that Jamie Doku looks like the greatest winger to ever grace this earth. But yeah, it's, you know, City say there are reasons why this is happening. You can see that. And it is a case of getting players back and getting that form back, because City were excellent in the sort of run up to those 3 draws and now the loss. You know, beating United easily, beating Bournemouth 6-1. So yeah, it's up to Guardiola to, you know, get him refreshed and ready to go for Luton away before, you know, the Club World Cup comes around, which is an interesting one to sort of break up the season. So yeah, fun few weeks ahead for City.
Yeah, 4 games without a win. I mean, by their standards, that is a pretty incredible slump. And I'm sure you're in lots of City WhatsApp groups, Will, because you're a fan, of course. And I mean, is there anyone tempted to ring up 5 Live and call Pep a fraud and say that he needs to go?
You think I'm more popular than I am. I mean, yeah, no, I think if anyone phoned up and asked for Pep to go, it'd be impressive. Yeah, look, the performances are bad tonight. Last night was a really bad performance. And as I say, there are reasons behind it. It's not like the players, they're all available and they're all playing poorly. Yeah, everyone played poorly last night. I don't think anyone comes out with any much credit. Edison made a couple of saves. I mean, Foden was awful. Bernardo, there's no point running through it, but they're all terrible. No, I did see someone tweet that it was worse than any performance they saw under Pellegrini, which I thought was quite funny. Yeah, you know, City will come back. They'll win more games. They'll finish first or second. You know, that's football for you. Let's all relax. Let's have a nice time. Christmas is coming up. Don't stress yourself over losing against a really good Aston Villa team. You know, well, you know, obviously, if you lose away to Villa, that ruins your Christmas and you might as well give up. But yeah, I mean, it's fine. It's football. Football is the king of short-termism. I'd probably not worry too much.
Well, speaking of not stressing yourself out, in other news, Manchester City have been charged by the Football Association following the furious confrontation with the referee Simon Hooper. They were charged on Monday by the FA, but Haaland has escaped censure under the FA's regulations around media use, which allow players to use social media after a game to criticise match officials' performance or competence. Only when a criticism implies bias or attacks the official's integrity can charges be considered. So WTF was adjudged to fall outside those criteria. So we see a flurry of those coming, I think. That'll do for part one. In part two, we'll continue to wade through the other Premier League midweek fixtures.
Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Luton 3, Arsenal 4. A cruel end to the game once again for Luton. A last-minute winner from Declan Rice in the 97th minute. This was lots of fun, though, wasn't it, Noz?
Oh, it was amazing. And it's one of those games where it's great to have Twitter open at the same time because you kind of like just when people like everyone like all the rival fans of Arsenal are really enjoying a goal, like suddenly they score and they all shut up. But it was an amazing game. One thing that I was a slight surprise to me, and maybe it shouldn't have been, is there was a lot of thirst for Rob Edwards on social media. Like I didn't realize how much of a heartthrob he is.
Oh yeah, no, he looks like those. If you buy a photo, he's the stock image in like the photo frame,
yeah.
Isn't he?
I get that, but by the same token, to me, his good looks are almost baddie good looks, like the bully in the high school film. So,
vibe.
I do. It's almost like he's too good looking. He's got the square jaw, like the perfect hair. So no, that was a slight surprise to me. It was an amazing game and. I continue to be impressed by Declan Rice. Like it's not as if he had his best game, but he's one of these players now, I think, that always, whenever you need him, he turns up with something. Whether that's sort of like a run breaking through the lines or an important goal, like he was one of those players where when he was at West Ham, and again, this says more about me than it does him, where I didn't quite get the hype. I was like, what is a Declan Rice? Like, what is so special about him? Why does everyone want him? And now it's obvious even to me that he's one of those talisman players. And he's almost developed this, as well as everything else, this almost Steven Gerrard sort of quality of coming up with big moments.
I think you're almost not allowed to be impressed by someone who cost over £100 million, which is ridiculous, but it's like they have to do something really, really special, like start levitating or something.
I think he's also disarming. He doesn't come across as like a superstar. And you've seen him when he does his like daft things, like being surprised and doing his little skits for the England camp. So like he's half like potentially world class midfielder and half CBBC presenter. So that's something that I've had to reconcile in my head.
Get him on Bedtime Story. That'll be the next one. Love that. So. Another late winner this time for Arsenal to add to the list. 89th minute winner at Brentford, equaliser late one at Chelsea, 86th minute winner at City. Winners against United in 96th and 101st minutes as well. Johnny, it's the age-old question. Is it the mark of champions that they get the job done, or is it slightly concerning that there's quite a lot of jeopardy in these games, it seems, with Arsenal?
Yeah, it is. I mean, this is the eternal debate. I think it's a testament to their fitness. I think it's a testament to their the mentality, because these things become self-prophesying after a while. If you score a few late goals and you begin to expect them, and you know, everyone remembers the Bournemouth game, for example, last season, and you know that late winner, and that you almost kind of portend them. Opposition fans do, and opposition teams begin, you know, they begin to get a little jittery. I mean, I think that the really encouraging thing for Arsenal is the way that different players have kind of stepped up. So Odegaard, who I thought was sensational in the second half, you know, who I thought maybe had gone slightly off the boil last few weeks, you know, he's come back with a vengeance. Martinelli, you know, he's back in the goals, and whereas like the early part of the season was kind of all about Saka and Nketiah, now Jesus has come back, he's got a goal. And, you know, there are different parts of the team are contributing at the times they're needed. And I think that's the sign of a really well-oiled machine. We don't, you know, we talked about Chelsea earlier, where the constituent parts don't seem to be working together. Arsenal is one of those teams where whatever they need, they almost kind of reverse engineer what they need to do, what they do from what they need to do. So whoever basically needs to step up, steps up. That's, you know, this unquantifiable thing in football. You know, how do you, you know, it's, I guess in other sports you'd call it clutch. And Arsenal are doing that. I think, you know, there is still a concern that their top level is not going to be enough to get to, you know, 95 points if it's one of those, you know, really high quality title races, but I think they've definitely got more than enough to get to 90. That may just be enough for them this season, and I think the level of their lowest performances has really risen this season. You know, you're not getting many stinkers out of them. That consistency, I think is a good thing, especially at this stage of the season.
Jim says, did anyone else enjoy Amazon showing the mistakes that Raya made for Luton's second and third goals, then cutting back to a smiling Ramsdale on the bench? Top contribution to the narrative that, yeah, I think you need a Ramsdale cam now, don't we? I mean, this is becoming quite, just, it's a story that keeps rumbling on. And, Will, I'm not sure, should Arteta get some criticism for the way this has been handled? Because it seems now they both look shaky when they play.
I don't think he should get criticism. He's made a decision, and a strong decision, that he wanted another goalkeeper that slightly different to Ramsdale and who he thinks is an upgrade. The only thing he needs to decide, really, is say, look, that's my number one. And go, if you want to go...
Well, he's not done that, has he? That's he's a bit woolly.
It is a bit woolly, but he really... He's not said it in public, but Raya's clearly the number one. I mean, Ramsdale's played... when Raya wasn't available against Brentford and not much else. It's, you know, it is what it is, but you've got to accept that Raya is the number one, and if he's probably just more nervous about the fact that he has got someone that's a number two behind him. And once you start making mistakes, as Andre Onana will tell you, you're going to keep making them. And that's just the nature. And if you're going to... He's not chopping and changing them unless completely necessary. So I think we just have to accept Raya's number one and move on and try and sell Ramsdale in January to Newcastle or something like that, because no point having your second choice goalkeeper giggling on the bench.
I'd like to continue to see his reactions, though. Maybe just like having a full picnic smorgasbord on the bench next time.
Couple of cans, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That'd be great.
I reckon we should have had a Max cam today. just with you sort of doing so well in his absence.
He's putting his hands above his head and clapping me. Good point. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But inside he's dying. Max will be back on Monday. This is not a coup. Arteta was booked for leaving his technical area after the last minute winner, so that's his third booking, so he'll be missing from the touchline for their game at Villa. The sound of the celebration police again, Noz. They can't keep them down, can we?
It's so funny. I just don't understand it. We celebration police was obviously all about rival fans saying, why are you celebrating, it's only whoever. And now referees have got involved, and I genuinely, I'm not joking, I don't understand the celebration thing with Arteta. Like, what was the problem? Was it the fact that it can't be affecting the game because the game can go on? Like Arteta could have been doing like a whole sort of routine, and the game could still have been going on while he was doing that. So it's not to sort of delay the game. There's something in the rule about something being choreographed, and it wasn't choreographed. It was just being happy. So it's such a strange one. But what it has done is it's given us Arsenal fans being disgruntled and looking through the archives and finding celebrations by managers, and sort of like there's a De Zerbi one going around of like, well, is this allowed and what is the sort of barometer? But yeah, I don't understand what got the officials unhappy about it. Is it the length of the celebration? Is it the amount of joy? Are they sort of trying to curtail the amount of joy? Because yeah, I think, and also the thing with Arteta is when he celebrates, he doesn't do that happy celebration. He does that kind of angry celebration of like proving people wrong and being very masculine about it. So I don't quite understand why he got done for it, but as a neutral, it's slightly funnier.
It is actually, because yeah, you're right. Is there a set criteria? I think it was technically because he left his technical area, which is something obviously that everyone's very, very, very upset about whenever he does it.
It should be adjusted to the size of the technical area. Kenilworth Road is, you know, it's a tiny pitch. It's a very cramped ground. You know, it's a very small technical area. Whereas at West Ham, for example, at the London Stadium, if you leave your technical anywhere, any reason, if you leave your technical area at West Ham, that should be an instant two-match touchline ban. There's no need to leave that area. Whereas I think Kenilworth Road, it's slightly more understandable. Have the Premier League, have they, you know, adjusted for, you know, what's the XL, you know, XTAL, X expected technical area leaving metric, you know, for each technical area. These are the things we need to know, because this is how humanity grows and prospers.
Maybe there could be a technical area, but then outside of that, there could be a celebration area.
Yes. Like a mosh pit, like a mosh pit. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Love that idea. Let's move on to Craven Cottage. Fulham 5, Nottingham Forest 0. We'll start with the big winners here, Fulham. They were brilliant. Biggest Premier League win since August 2012. Raul Jimenez scoring twice. He struggled so far this season. For his second, he rounds the keeper and scores a delicious back heel. And, Will, we haven't seen that sort of confidence from him consistently, actually, since before that awful head injury. So that's from the neutral perspective, that was really lovely to see, actually.
Yeah, you know, he was in incredible form prior to the head injury, and since then he's really struggled to get back, and obviously you're never going to know exactly whether it's confidence and, you know, fear of, you know, going into these games. But once we've discussed confidence a lot, it really does help you. If you are willing to go around the goalkeeper and back heel it in, then you're probably in a good place in your life and football. It's nice to see, because he does, you know, it was a long road back. Anyone that has that sort of lengthy time out is bad. And you've seen players that have suffered similar injuries like Ryan Mason that couldn't come back. And which makes it even more understandable that Raul Jimenez has taken time to adapt and recover and, get back to playing the way he can do. And he's had to move clubs now, and obviously different environment there. And, you know, it's not like it sort of was great from the start at Fulham. It's taken time, but he's getting games, and, you know, it's a big job as well at Fulham to replace Mitrovic, and it was a very sort of short notice that he was off. So yeah, no, it's fantastic to see, and, you know, Fulham playing some good football, and Marco Silva's doing a great job down there, and it'll be very safe and comfortable, and they'll have a nice mid-table season, it looks like. So, you know, they can back heel them all in from 0 yards, because they won't get relegated, it's fine.
That doesn't seem so. Another really good performance from Andreas Pereira as well. Forest, on the other hand, they've lost their last four, conceding 12 goals in the process. Image of the night goes to Don Manning on X, who posted a picture of owner Evangelos Marinakis, his press pass that was jammed in a hedge outside Craven Cottage. Now, I might be reading it too much into this, Johnny, but I'm not sure that's a good sign for Steve Cooper's future.
Yeah, all of the kind of stories in the papers that he's going to be sacked, maybe even as soon as this week. Lopetegui's been mentioned. Marco Silva actually is a coach that they like. You know, not that I think Fulham would want to let him go. Yeah, I don't think it is a good sign. And obviously, it's a strange thing this season, because Forest fans, you know, they have been really clear about where their loyalties lie. They've been singing Cooper's name. They even sang his name after, you know, a 5-0 road defeat in midweek. And I think that shows, you know, he's clearly a good coach and he's clearly a decent guy. I don't think he's necessarily blameless for this. You know, everyone talks about the chaos and, you know, the 40 players coming in or whatever. Ultimately, it's Cooper's job to get a team, you know, out on the pitch that basically looks like they know what they're doing. And at times Forest have, and at times they haven't. And I think it's been the goals they're shipping in recent games. What Forest have kind of never really done for me is that they've never kind of tried to really convince me of how they actually want to play. They've switched between formations, they switched between goalkeepers, obviously, you know, that massive personnel coming in and out, but I've never really got a defined kind of identity or playing style. Well, you know, but do they want to be a sort of a pragmatic, close down the space kind of team? Do they want to be an expansive kind of team? I don't think Cooper's ever kind of managed to reconcile those two poles and come up with a kind of a coherent identity. And obviously, you know, circumstances make that a lot harder. But you know, I think, you know, he's a decent guy, and not knowing him, obviously, I don't know him. I can't make a judgment on his character, but he seems like a decent bloke and a decent coach. This is kind of the way of things. You know, you are a slave to results, and Forest just haven't been good enough recently.
To Crystal Palace, they lost 2-0 to Bournemouth. I was there, and it was grim. They were really, really bad. Crystal Palace, nothing in attack. Bournemouth were good enough. Didn't really have to be that good, though, to beat Palace. So Bournemouth building, actually, they kept their nerve with Iraola. Possibly could have pulled the trigger on him, but they're now unbeaten in 4-3 wins, 9 points clear of the relegation zone. There were lots of booing at half-time and full-time. 1 point from games against Everton, Luton, West Ham and Bournemouth, and it's Liverpool and Manchester City in their next two games. And Noz, I'm not sure what you made of this. I don't know if you saw, but Roy Hodgson, after the game, saying that fans have been spoilt in recent years.
I'm always fascinated by Roy Hodgson, because on the one hand, he seems like such a genial, lovely chap, but like, I think there's a slight element of bricktop about him. He's got like this old school gangster type, sort of like speaking very sort of like softly spoken, but sort of like with a menace. Like it's the way he said the fans have been spoiled in recent times. It's the way he sort of I think more than one occasion he called Bournemouth a little club or something. That was a bit strange.
Yeah, that's right.
and then somebody mentioned that that a bottle had been thrown in his direction, and he said something like, "What, you mean to tell me a fella's unhappy with me? Well, I'll definitely won't sleep well tonight." And I'm like, what is all this sass? It's kind of like this. He's kind of gone to war like with the Palace fans, and I'm not sure it's the best tactic, but I mean, who knows? Maybe he'll turn it around and the fans will be fine. But there's not a great atmosphere around Palace at the moment, and it's I think it's one of those fan bases that if you get them behind you, they're amazing, but you do not want to get on the wrong side of them, and you certainly don't want to kind of go to war with them publicly, which bricktop Hodgson seems to have done at the moment.
He doesn't like he might be packing, doesn't he? Like, you just wouldn't be that surprised if he kind of unleashed something from his coat. Yeah, this was a man who squared up to a player earlier on this season. It's been quite the time for Roy Hodgson. And actually, the talk of the gantry, because I'm not in the know at all, but just a couple of the guys up there were saying that Doogie Friedman really covered Steve Cooper. And I think they were trying to get him after Patrick Vieira because they thought he was going to be sacked by Nottingham Forest. So could we see that happening, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be a really great move, obviously. Hodgson always, you know, has never felt like more than a stopgap. And, you know, he's done a decent job, I think. But there is so much more. I think, you know, there is so much more that Palace can be as a kind of a story. You know, this is a really kind of authentic South London club that draws a lot of its, you know, a lot of its players and a lot of its pride and a lot of identity from the local community. You've got this, you know, Croydon, like this guy from Croydon managing his almost his hometown club. You know, there should be kind of an excitement about this. And but the problem with Hodgson is that he's clearly, you know, a very, very smart guy who needs to be taken, you know, he feels like he needs to get the credit for being smart at all times. And when, you know, when you're kind of perennially 14th in the Premier League, it kind of looks, it feels like you're going nowhere. And there are not many opportunities to prove your genius. And I think, you know, that's basically the problem. You need a coach. I mean, we talked about Ange at Spurs.
Oh, here we go. People love it when you talk about Ange, Johnny. They love it.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
I don't, yeah, I mean, people just they really just want to hear more about me on Ange, I think. But, you know, there is... One of the reasons he's so popular is that he kind of sells a dream. He sells a vision. You know, you're not actually going anywhere in a, you know, if you're a mid-table club like Palace or Wolves, they'll be fine, right? But you need to sell a journey. You need to sell some kind of hope. And Hodgson has never kind of, he's never bought into that. He's like, well, you know, when I was, if you take a 30-year span of Palace history, actually, you know, they've been in the top division, actually not for a huge amount of time. So you should, and that is just not how fandom works. I don't know how long it is, has been, you know, it's been since Hodgson has actually been a fan. But, you know, if he doesn't get that a coach of a Premier League club with such a strong tie to its local community needs to offer something more than just, well, we've delivered 7 straight quarters of economic growth. It's basically that in managerial form.
You'll never sing that.
You know, then he doesn't get what you know what this job is about, weirdly enough. So you know, Palace probably need to find someone who can, who does get it.
Sheffield United 0, Liverpool 2. Chris Wilder's return ends in defeat. Will, I mean, he's come in for Paul Heckingbottom. Perhaps they're hoping for a bit of a managerial bounce, and the fact he's been there before. I mean, it sort of makes sense, but do you give them any chance of improving on their position?
Yeah, he lives nearby, so that helps.
He was in the area.
That was convenient. Yeah, Sheffield United are going down. Let's all accept this. There's no chance of staying up. They tried really hard last night and it wasn't good enough against Liverpool, who weren't playing particularly well. They don't have the quality in the team. They don't have anyone that's going to score the goals to get them out of it. They don't have the quality in from goalkeeper right through the team. They sold the best 2 players on the eve of the season. They've tried to replace them with players that are, I would argue, slightly inferior. They're going to try really hard for the rest of the season. They're going to come up a bit short because they're not a Premier League team, unfortunately. And that's the nature of what's happening at Bramall Lane. And I'm sure Chris Wilder will get the best out of them because that's the sort of coach he is. And he did very well there last time, but they just don't have the quality. And I don't think they're going to be having a big January to try and turn it around in terms of investment.
We could be 2008 Derby areas here, right? They got 5 points after 15 games. They're getting worse. Like, what is that? That translates to about 12 points over a 38 game.
They were a little bit better last night.
They really were. I only saw the highlights, but the number of times that they let a Liverpool cross just bounce or a free header 12 yards out. And this is like the, you know, I don't want to sound like some ex-pro on TalkSport, but these are the basics of football. You know, you've got to defend your life. You've got to defend. Like, if you're a promoted team and you are not defending the area around your penalty spot when a cross comes in, then literally what is the point of you?
In other news, Johnny Lou, I need to ask you, is there anything funny about 12:30 kickoff?
Well, so I mean, so this is in reference to Klopp, who got, you know, it was Amazon last night.
Yeah,
you know, some jokey question about 12:30 kickoff. That's just, lose it. So, you find this funny? You're a professional, you find this funny? You know, there are certain things, you know, we got taught in our household, there are certain things you don't joke about, you know, religion, you know, politics, you know, like tragedy, you know, war, famine, death.
Yeah.
And now we can add, you know, I think we can add 12:30 kickoffs to that, you know, maybe there was a time in the past where, you know, joking about, in a slightly less enlightened age, where you could joke about 12:30 kickoffs, you know, you'd see comedians from the past making gags about, you know, eating pasta for breakfast. But we, you know, we live in a different age now. What is, it's not acceptable to the, you know, people will rail about political correctness and, you know, things going woke. But, you know, I think it's right that we have these red lines as a society, that we have things that say, no, this is beyond the pale. This is beyond the boundaries of good taste. And you know, I'm just glad that Klopp has enforced that, you know, reinforced that line last night.
Can't say anything these days, can you? Just can't. That's it for part two. In part three, more Premier League, and we'll also discuss the Women's Nations League. Welcome back to the Guardian Football Weekly. Brighton 2, Brentford 1. Jack Hinshelwood of the Hinshelwood footballing dynasty. Good to have another one. Winning goal, 18 years old. Another cliche coming. Brighton with the great recruitment and the academy as well. So Brighton, a deserved win. But strange stat that they're the first team to score and concede in each of their opening 15 games of a top flight campaign since Wolves did this in each of their first 16 matches back in 1934-35. And I'm sure if Wilson was here, he'd tell us about the manager Frank Buckley's gung-ho style. That's good research from producer Joel there. Noz, they seem to be finding their inner Brighton again after a bit of time in the wilderness, Brighton.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it's interesting what you said before about Steve Cooper sort of possibly being up for a job, but then not getting sacked. I think with De Zerbi, like he was linked to too many troublesome clubs like Manchester United and Chelsea. And he thought, like, let's have a bit of poor form here just to sort of knock myself out of the running for those two messes. So he's successfully done that. And now Brighton can go back to being good again. I think they did really well. I mean, there was like I know all teams seem to have like injury crises at the moment, but I think this game, like, was like nearly 20 absentees in this game. So I think Brighton did well. Both teams did well considering all the players that were missing. But that stat about goals conceded and scored again, that just points to the fact that whenever Brighton play, you kind of look forward to the game. Whenever they're on telly or whatever, you kind of like, well, at least this will be a good game. And when they win, that's a bonus. So yeah, very, very, very good. But also like I was desperate for De Zerbi to sort of do a outlandish celebration again, just to sort of like double down and annoy Arsenal fans. But he kind of held back. But yeah, they still hold.
I'm sure that's in the post, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah, Brentford are surely up there with the how many injuries we've got competition. Balcombe, Hickey, Aya, Collins, Henry, De Silva, Norgaard, Jensen, Sharder, Tony unavailable, although will be available soon, Damsgaard. And then Bumo came off injured in this game, did score a penalty. But they've got Ethan Pinnock, so they're going to be absolutely fine, as we know. We're stands here on the Guardian Football Weekly for Ethan Pinnock. Wolves 1, Burnley 0, Hwang with the only goal. Burnley started quite well, looked like they were going to build on their good 5-0 win over Sheffield United at the weekend until Wolves scored just before half-time. Well, it looks like it is going to be a season of struggle for Burnley, isn't it? Despite that really good win at the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, the goal they conceded, with their architects of their own downfall. That's how they're going to play. They're going to pass out from the back, and it's not always going to work because they're not a Manchester City level side. And it was a mistake, and that is unfortunate. But Company's not going to change. We've all accepted that. I was at the West Ham game where they were 1-0 up going into the 86th minute, and then West Ham equalised, and I was like, oh, I'm not going to rewrite my intro here. I think this is going to end up 2-1, and it did. So that was convenient. They're lacking Premier League quality. Jay Rodriguez is up front. Again, they beat Sheffield United 5-0, and fair play to them and whoever else does that this season. But yeah, it's going to be a struggle because they've got a lot of young players, limited Premier League experience. Most of the players that have got Premier League experience, the last time they were in the Premier League, they got relegated. Sanderberg, Charlie Taylor, Brownhill, Goodmanson. They've got a young goalkeeper. It's going to be very difficult for them, and you know, pragmatism won't allow Company to change to a slightly more robust style, I guess. But, you know, they'll be entertained to watch. They'll win a few games, but it's going to be an interesting struggle between that bottom four. But I'm looking forward to it. I hope they stay up and maybe they can build on it. But yeah, I think the problems with Burnley go back to some sort of very average recruitment in the summer, I'd say, and, you know, very much sticking to the model they want to. And sometimes it's not always black and white when it comes to signing players, with a few grey areas, and maybe those grey areas are getting a bit more Premier League experience in. But, you know, we'll see how they go.
It was another really good finish from Hwang, his eighth of the season for Wolves. Just on a wider point, out of the three promoted teams, I should say, who do you think's going to make the best fist of staying up, Johnny? I mean, just from what I've seen, it looks like Luton just have that little bit about them, maybe not the quality, but the sort of mentality, maybe.
No, I think it is Luton. And I think it's a combination of the fact that Kenilworth Road is such a tough place to go. You know, Liverpool have struggled there. I think City go there this weekend. And obviously Arsenal as well. And the fact that, you know, they have this blend of they've signed experience, you know, they've signed kind of, you know, Premier League quality and, you know, the likes of Barkley and Andros Townsend, but they haven't kind of gone overboard on it. They've just sort of sprinkled it through the team like grated cheese. So they still have essentially the core of the squad that got them up from the Championship, and that comes with, you know, what we talked about earlier, like a defined identity. And when times are tough, you know, they will go through a spell where they probably don't win in 10 or 15. That defined style, you know, building up through the, you know, the wing backs and swinging crosses in and just being really solid and scrapping for second balls, that will kind of stand them in good stead. I think more than the other two sides, who I think have a, you know, obviously Burnley have a defined style. They really do lack quality. Sheffield United, I don't know what they're trying to do at all. But when I still kind of expect all three of them to go down. But I think Luton are currently making the best fist of it.
To the Women's Nations League. So the two scorelines that mattered in terms of Team GB failing to qualify: England 6, Scotland 0. But Netherlands 4, Belgium 0, a real roller coaster. England went into this needing to better Netherlands' score by 3 goals or more. They were 6 still up, but then full time at Hampden Park, and Netherlands scored another to mean that it's the Netherlands who go through to the Nations League finals, which was the way that Team GB were going to qualify for the Olympics in Paris. You're no stranger to a controversial statement, Johnny. Scotland were, of course, saying, we will not roll over. We will not lose this because we are motivated to beat England. And that this sort of suggestion that because it's Team GB and some of our players might make the squad, it makes no difference to us. I don't think they did it. They just weren't very good, were they?
No, exactly. But I think you can't give it the big I am. You can't give it all this about, oh, you can't question our integrity and then defend like that. It just doesn't sit right. You know, and I'm not questioning their, you know, their sporting integrity, but I think you can definitely contest their defensive integrity. To be fair to them, I mean, once they went, you know, I guess 5-0 down, they actually played all right. They actually had quite a few chances to make it 5-1. They certainly didn't lie down. I think it's a really inconsistent side, and for all the talent in it, I don't think they can produce results on a consistent basis. I think, you know, they're going to get relegated to League B now or whatever it is, and, you know, England just ran over them. And, you know, there is this debate about whether it's a, you know, it's a good summer to miss. But I think, you know, if you talk to Wiegmann afterwards, or the players, they clearly wanted to play in Paris. It's like there's something special about an Olympic Games, and maybe you don't get it so much in this country where, you know, England are constantly competing in international tournaments. But the Olympics is special, and particularly in women's football, it holds a real special place in the heritage of the game and the growth of the game. And, you know, they might, you know, people might be putting on a bit of a brave face now, but when they turn on their telly next summer and England aren't in it, it's going to hurt.
Well, Ellen White was part of our team, and that was the thing that really interested me, was because obviously I was thinking, oh, we know good, they'll get a rest, and is it that big a deal? But when she played for Team GB, she said it was such an amazing experience because you're in the Olympic Village, kind of mixing with all the other athletes, and that was the experience that she really, really enjoyed. Noz, would you like to take the Barry Glendening question here? Lauren James is good, isn't she?
She is. She's there was at least there was no sort of photo on social media by her brother where like she's cropped out and he's like center frame. So that was good. No, I mean,
does that happen?
Yeah, there was he tweeted something like, "I'm so proud of my sister" or something, and she was like half cropped out of the picture, and he was sort of like the center of it. But yeah, no, again, I mean, the thing I loved about that 6-0 game was as much as obviously Scotland got thrashed, like. Every save, every tackle was worth it because ultimately, like, one more goal would have made all the difference. So it just goes to show that you can get absolutely mauled, but it does matter. Every save, every sort of last ditch tackle, every block, it was worth it just to piss on England's parade. So I love that, and also. And again, I absolutely don't mean this in a patronizing way, but I love the fact that again on social media it was such a big thing. Like everyone was invested. There was other games happening at the same time, but certainly on my timeline, everyone was talking about this game and the drama again. I mean, it's bittersweet because on the one hand, like it was amazing that everyone was invested and drama like this just. Amplifies women's football even more, but then you do kind of think, especially in this country, selfishly, the Olympics would have been great just to have that sort of involvement. But yeah, no, it was. I mean, any sort of like the more shithousery in women's football, the better.
Agreed. More of that, please. Well, I'm not sure if you have a view on this, but the whole Team GB thing actually does seem to cause quite a lot of problems. Not least because they were put in the same group, which probably could have been avoided. But just generally, really does seem to cause a few issues.
Yeah, I mean, it's in men's football, Team GB is obviously had London 2012, but it's never been a thing and no one really cares. But it is the biggest event. Well, it was one of the biggest events of women's football. You know, I spoke to Karen Carney recently and she loved it and desperate that England... got there to help Team GB qualify. But yeah, it's a very weird situation of how it's done. Like surely if any of the four nations come top, they should, or, you know, come in a qualifying position, then Team GB should qualify. But yeah, it was very poorly organised on every level. And, you know, it's just a very strange concept that, you know, four teams become one for a major tournament. I mean, might need to review how the qualification's done because it doesn't make any sense.
Well, that'll do for today, I think. Just a word on Christine Sinclair's retirement from international football. Finished an astonishing career in front of 48,000 fans at BC Place Stadium, temporarily renamed Christine Sinclair Place, Canadian international, 331 caps, 190 international goals, a record. Johnny Lou is on the move, leaving his hotel. Can we follow you for the rest of the day, Johnny? Do you think this is quite exciting?
I'd love to, but I'm about to get into the lift and I think I'm not sure the Wi-Fi is going to hold out. But yeah, lovely. Oh shit, almost missed the lift.
We'll keep this going. But Johnny, thank you so much for your time and hope you catch your train.
Cheers.
Thank you, Will.
Thank you very much. And Joey Barton thinks you did very well today, Robin. Well done.
Oh, thank you, sir. That means a lot. Yeah. Have my dad will write in as well, like Ramsdale's dad. That's the thing now, isn't it? Noz, thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And can I just say to Australia and North London that like, I'm a massive fan of a Big Ange. Just for a bit of balance, because like when we ask questions on social media, like I was kind of shocked by the torrent of like, oh, is there going to be more propaganda? So yeah, I'm just on the other. I'm with you guys.
All I've been imagining since that tweet is Johnny being in the British Embassy in Australia, sort of a la Bart Simpson getting booted through a gate.
With a humongous boot.
Yeah, Johnny seems to have gone now. The Wi-Fi's gone there. We can say what we want about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, a lot of people have been saying the anti-USA agenda is nothing now compared to the anti-Aussie one. Max will be back and that will certainly improve on that scale on Monday. But we'll be back tomorrow. Thank you so much for listening. Football Weekly is produced by Joel Grove, and our executive producer is Max Sanderson.
This is The Guardian.